got my bags packed, I'm on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 225. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about trains and castles and the Royals as we go to Wales. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, I do have three news stories for you. The first one is that Lindsay Lohan has been banned from India. Apparently, the actress and sometimes troublemaker was claiming to have been involved in a child labor raid, and they found out she wasn't even in the country, and that attention made them look into her passport and found that she was doing a documentary but didn't have a press visa. And so for now, she's been banned. The TSA is going to be doing a random swabbing of airline passengers' hands searching for explosives. At least unlike the shoe carnival, this actually might be productive, but it's something to be aware of if you're going to the airport. And then speaking of security and airports and things that are less productive, we've already seen our first sexual harassment lawsuit because of those body scanners, because one thoughtless security person in Heathrow Airport in London managed to comment to a woman after she had gone through the scanner about, well, let's just say he was admiring a certain portion of her anatomy, and he's being sued. For links to all those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome the show John Clayton, who's coming to us from Southern California. Although, John, I suspect from your accent you may not be originally from Southern California. John has come to talk to us about Wales. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, thank you. No, obviously I'm not from Texas. I'm originally from London. I've been in this great country 45 years, and I'm a proud American citizen. I spent 16 years on LA radio with a travel show called Travel with a Difference, and I used to share with people offbeat different things about the world of travel. And I'm a train buff, a steam train buff. And last year, I was invited by the Welsh Tourist Board to go to Wales and see and enjoy some of their absolutely fantastic narrow gauge trains. When you ask me, and you haven't asked me yet, but when you ask me what narrow gauge is, most trains in North Wales, narrow gauge are approximately 2'7" wide.
Oh, really? Just that wide? So now, narrow gauge, I'm assuming because of that, and because we're talking about Wales, we're talking about some of the older trains probably still running in the world at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Chris. What a lot of people don't know is that starting in about 1850 to 1950, Wales was the slate capital of the world. And most of the slate mines were in the middle of the country. And for people who don't know this, Wales is on the left side, as it were, of England, the part that sort of juts out on the left-hand side of England. Wales was the slate capital of the world. And so they'd have these trains that ran from the slate mines to the coast where they'd pick up ships to go around the world. And in about the 1900s, they decided that it was also a good passenger vehicle. So they added railway carriages for passengers. And then I suppose in the late part of the last century, a lot of these sort of went into disrepair. But about 10 years ago, the Welsh government and the tourism board decided to spend a great deal of money refurbishing and making these trains sort of, sounds funny to say brand new, but brand new as it were. Uh-huh. And there were three main railroads, and I'll get to that in just a second. But we went to one of the depots of one, the Festiniog Railroad. And it was absolutely fascinating. You had guys there who were in their 50s and 60s, real railroad aficionados, and they would completely rebuild some of the steam engines from like 100 years ago. And if you'd look at them,
oh my,
you would really think that they were from 100 years ago, but they were in fact built in sort of like 1990. But yes, to answer your question, it is a real look back into the history of steam railroading This is really absolutely one of the tourist attractions in the United Kingdom, and it is truly a tourism thing for, as I laughingly say, kids of all ages, because it is mystical, marvelous, and absolutely magical. And certainly, if you go to Wales, and I urge you to go to Wales, I urge you to see some of these railroads. Chris, I mentioned the railroads in North Wales, the three right. ones that we as a travel group went to, and I say travel group, it was travel journalists. We went to the Mount Snowdon Railroad, we went aboard the West Highland Railway, and we went along the Festiniog. All of them are fantastic, but if you only have time to go on one, I would urge your audience to go on the Festiniog one.
Okay, and where does that start from? What is our itinerary if we're going to repeat your trip, for instance?
It is awfully hard for me to pronounce the Welsh names. You're laughing. I would suggest that you go to their websites. One of the most interesting websites in this whole thing is greatlittletrainsofwales.co.uk, and look up the Festiniog Railroad. Their particular website is FestRail. But if you do that, you will get an idea of where it runs to and where it runs from in North Wales.
Okay. And this is North Wales, so if I was to fly in, for instance, from the States, I would probably fly into...
You know, that's another interesting question that I was always asked about Wales. There are several ways to get to Wales. Yes, the easiest, fastest way to get there is to fly into London Heathrow. And then you can do one of two things. You can either rent a car in London and drive to Wales on their motorways, which is equivalent to our freeways, or you can take a flight to Manchester.
Oh, to Manchester, okay.
The problem about going to Manchester, as I just described, is too long and too difficult. But if you want to do that, it's obviously an option. But the easiest, most interesting way is, as I said, to rent a car. The only challenge, and I'm laughing about that, the only challenge in renting a car in England and obviously Wales is that you drive on right. the wrong side of the road, the gear shift is on the wrong side. But if you do rent a car, I would strongly, strongly urge your audience to rent an automatic. It is too difficult to drive on the wrong side and right. then think about the stick shift. But that is the easiest, fastest way to do it.
Okay. Now, obviously, there's also good rail connections there if we don't want to
rent
a car.
Yeah, that is a third way. Rail in England is one of, in fact, rail in Europe is right. one of the joys of visiting England, Scotland, Wales, and obviously Europe. The trains are very fast. They're modern. They're comfortable. The train station you'd leave from would probably be Paddington. Okay. And you can find out all that information by going to the Rail Europe website, which is one of the most interesting rail websites in the world, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. You mentioned the one particular trip that you pointed out of the three that you did that really stood out for you. Why that trip?
I think it's because of several reasons. One is that we were on the train for about 45 minutes, and in that 45 minutes, you go through some of the most gorgeous, incredible countryside. You get to see things that the other three railroads sort of touch on very briefly. One of the neat things, especially in the Festiniog trip that I'm talking about, is, and I know your audience will be interested in this, you can actually ride up front with the engineer, or as they call them in the United Kingdom, the driver. It is a really interesting experience, but I would also warn your audience to be sure that when you do that, you keep your head well inside the cab.
Because you've got embers and smoke coming out of the old steam engine.
Well, no, I was ridiculed by some of my fellow journalists because I am an avid photographer, and I was shooting all these wonderful pictures looking out of the cab from the engineer's point of view, and the rock face, the cuttings and the embankments that you go through are truly about 3 or 4 inches from the side of the track. So unless you pay close attention, you could easily have your head separated from the rest of your body.
Now let's try and avoid that. What was the highlight of the trip for you?
As a railroad buff, we did a lot of different things and they wanted us to see and do a lot of things. I'd say there were two things. One, the trip up Mount Snowdon, and two, the journey on the Festiniog Railroad I've just described to you. The trip out Mount Snowdon is a really interesting trip. Mount Snowdon is the highest mountain peak in England in the United Kingdom. It is approximately 3,500 foot in height. The journey to the top in the rack and pinion train that you go on lasts approximately 1 hour. It is thrilling, exciting, mesmerizing, tantalizing. And when you get to the top on a clear day, you can see England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. And as they say, the five kingdoms, the fifth kingdom being heaven. There is a wonderful sort of refreshment area at the top that was recently rebuilt. It costs, I believe, $10 million. But the journey is really mesmerizing. And the interesting thing is there are trains going up and there are trains going down. And there are three separate double loops along the track so that both trains can pass one another and the trains go about 5 miles an hour. But it is one of the most interesting trips because you have these soaring sort of not canyons, but huge valleys and peaks. And you're right on the edge there. And it is really mesmerizing. And as I just said before, the Festiniog one is really neat and really interesting. So those two are the ones I'd recommend for your audience.
You mentioned briefly, we mentioned in passing that the Welsh names are a little more challenging for those of us who are not Celtic. There's a richness of the culture there. What am I missing if I've been to London, I've been to England, but I haven't gone to Wales?
I think the interesting thing about that is when I left England about 300 years ago, there was the United Kingdom. But in the last, I would say the last 15, 20 years, there has evolved a really distinct nationality of Scotland, of Wales and England, and to a much lesser degree, Northern Ireland. Scotland and Wales have really become their own country in their own right. Both those places, Scotland and Wales, have their own government, and they're very proud of their heritage. The Welsh language is taught in schools in Wales. You will often hear people talking Welsh. It is a different side of the United Kingdom that you never see unless you know about it. And that seems kind of an obvious statement, but people say, I'm going to go to England. And then you say, well, why didn't you go to Wales? And a lot of people will say, incredibly, Wales, are you talking about things in the ocean? You say, no, Wales, W-A-L-E-S. It is fascinating. And they're a really proud people. And the scenery, especially in Northern Wales, there are parts of Northern Wales that you would swear with Switzerland. I mean, you've got these gorgeous peaks, wonderful valleys, incredible crashing mountain streams. It's really a visual feast for the eyes.
Excellent. Now, when I go there and I do my travel planning ahead of time, I've got my guidebook with me. What's it going to recommend that I should go see that you think, I don't know why they recommend that, and what does it miss?
I think one of the problems, and we can talk briefly here about guidebooks. Well, let's start on guidebooks. When I was on LA Radio, that was one of the most frequently asked questions. John, what do you think about guidebooks? Well, so many guidebooks are, and I use this word advisedly, boring. They're really filled with a lot of extraneous information, and you have to sift through page after page of stuff that really doesn't interest you. Having said that, I always found that for people who want a guidebook but don't want endless pages, the Michelin Green Guides are absolutely fascinating. They're fascinating because they give you the highlights. They show you in maps and pictures especially what is worth seeing. They don't give you long, long descriptions, and they highlight what is most interesting to the usual sort of traveler. Another guidebook that sort of comes in that category is the ones called the Rough Guides. A quick example, rough guides are very good if you're into some of the offbeat things. Just let's take Poland as an example. When I went to Poland, I got their rough guide, and I found that in looking over things to see and do in Warsaw, there was an absolutely fascinating piece about a church in Warsaw that had been completely demolished by Nazi tanks in World War II. And to commemorate the bravery of the Polish partisans, the Polish partisans had seized a piece of a German tank, the tracks, and saved it through the end of the war, and it is now embedded as part of the new building for that new church. And only something, as I've found, something like the Rough Guides give you that information. So Rough Guides are certainly something to look at. Another one that I would urge your audience to consider would be Insight Guides. Insight Guides are interesting because if you have no idea what a place looks like, you'll find that Insight Guides produce a lot of really top quality photographs and sort of diagrams. So it's a really good book. So if you're going to go to Wales and you want to know really interesting things to see and do, I would urge your audience to get a Michelin Green Guide and also to get the Insight Guide.
Okay. And even with that, though, how would you critique it? What do they leave out and what do they overemphasize?
I think they cover an enormous amount of really, as I just said, boring stuff. Yeah, they cover a lot of history. I mean, you can go through several pages if you're interested in history, obviously. If you're not interested in the history, they will go after page on page on some cathedrals, on how this came about, what the history of that was. And you say to yourself, my goodness, I'm not interested in all that. I just want to know what the interesting things to see and do are. And the two publications I've mentioned will give you that information. You can look at the size of a publication. I mean, the Green Guides are usually, I don't know, maybe half an inch to an inch thick. And other guides that have all this boring information can be anywhere from 2 to 3 inches. So go to a library, go to a bookstore and look at them, and you will instantly see which is the preferable one for you to buy.
And while we're in that area, what are sort of your top three things that we should see? Maybe that people don't normally see.
That is an interesting observation. As I say, I went there because I was interested in steam trains. But in addition to steam trains, there are several things. You want to stay in some really wonderful bed and breakfasts, and I'll get to that in just 1 second. But I would urge listeners, first of all, to go up Mount Snowdon. That is really interesting. To go back to the Welsh history thing, when you go on the Mount Snowdon Railway, and that comes from a place called Llanberis, and just as a talk on Welsh words, Llanberis is spelled L-L-A-N-B-E-R-I-S, so, you know, double letters. But at Llanberis, and before you get on the train, there is an absolutely mesmerizing recreation of a Welsh slate mine. It's all exactly as it was back in the day, but more importantly, or equally importantly, you will find that about every hour on the hour, they have a really riveting display of a Welsh slate, I don't know what you call them, a slate expert, I guess, who shows you in a very amusing display how they split slate. It's literally about 2 minutes from where you board the train for Mount Snowdon, and it's probably worth spending, I would say, at least an hour there. You don't need to take a bus or a car because it's right there. So the Llanberis slate mine is fascinating. In terms of things to see and do, Wales, like much of the United Kingdom, has a lot of castles. In Carnarvon, they have a wonderful castle there. There are some terrific places for you to shoot really creative photographs of Carnarvon Castle. But if you were to list, say, the top three things, I would say, one, the miniature steam trains. And I used to say miniature steam trains, which were really steam trains for kids, but are really for adults. The next thing would be to visit some of the castles. And the third thing would be to stay in some of the really wonderful B&Bs there. A very quick example that I would truly urge your audience to do. Just outside Carnarvon, there is a wonderful, incredible place called Plas Dinas, P-L-A-S-D-I-N-A-S. Plas Dinas happens to be, or used to be, the home of the Armstrong-Jones family. Armstrong-Jones is the family that comes from Wales, and their son was a guy called Tony, who ended up marrying Princess Margaret. For many years, Princess Margaret and Tony Armstrong Jones stayed in this house. And about 30 years ago, the Armstrong Jones sold this house, and it is now a wonderful B&B. But what makes it especially interesting, and again, you can go there for lunch or stay there, which I would urge you to do, but you can go there and all over the house, and I mean all over the house, in the hallways, in the bedrooms, there are these wonderful memories, or memorabilia, if you like, of Princess Margaret and Tony Armstrong Jones. Memorabilia like photographs, like books and scrapbooks and notes and things that say, to Tony from Margaret, the things from the Queen and King of England. For anyone interested in English royalty, this place is an absolute must. And they have eight or 11 rooms. I can't remember. I think they have 11 rooms. The food there is absolutely to die for. And even if you just go there for lunch, which they would obviously welcome, I would urge your audience to go there because it is a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
And you say the food there is that traditional Welsh fare?
It is. And if you ask me what Welsh traditional fare is, I don't know. But one of the national emblems of Wales are leeks, L-E-E-K-S. And if you can find a good restaurant that serves cream of leek soup, it is to die for. Most of the food, in fact, every place that we went in Wales, the food is always excellent. It is very tasty. It is just a real sort of gourmet experience. There is one other thing, and I don't know how we're here for time, but you asked me what things people should do. On the north coast of Wales, there is a wonderful place called Port Merion. Merion, by the way, is spelled M-E-I-R-I-O-N. Port Merion is the creation of a really offbeat, crazy English architect. And listen to this wonderful name, Sir Bertram Clow Williams Ellis. Wow, I mean, what a name. He was an architect who in the 1920s decided to build this really offbeat, creative, amazing little village. And the village is amazing because it is a collection of unique shaped houses, all of them different colors, all of them different sizes. It is right on the coast. And for any of your audience who happened to see a wonderful British television show in the 60s called The Prisoner I can't remember the name of the actor, but anyway, Patrick McGee or something like that. Most of the show was filmed there. He was sort of sent in exile to this village, and of course, most people remember it from that. But it is a wonderful collection of all these things I've just described, wonderful gardens. It's right on the coast, and down at the bottom of Port Merion is this absolutely wonderful hotel that you can stay in. It is also a great place for dinner. And the whole thing is, again, a must-see experience.
Okay. As we start to wind this down, one thing that surprised you the last trip you made to Wales?
Oh, golly. I think the thing that really surprised me was I've been away from England so long, and I touched on it briefly just now. I think the thing that really surprised me was how nationalistic the Welsh have become. As I said before, when I left England 300 years ago, it was just part of England. And now they've developed this real nationality. And when you leave, and this is really interesting, when you leave Wales, let's say in a car, you really feel as if you've left the country. I mean, obviously you have, but you get a real sense when you go to Wales that you really are, and this sounds funny, you really are overseas in a completely different, you know, location. So as I say, the thing that really surprised me and thrilled me was that they've developed this real national pride and love and joy and all the wonderful things their country offers.
Isn't that interesting with the EU, how we're seeing the resurgence of the Catalonians in Barcelona and the Welsh and the Scottish and the smaller groups that had been in many ways subsumed before this?
You're right. I'm going to just touch on something that I've always been amazed at about the United Kingdom. The British, the Welsh and the Scottish always say Great Britain and Europe. And yet, if you look at a map, to my knowledge, England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales is part of Europe. But to the British, the Welsh, and the Scotch, There is Great Britain, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and then there is Europe. They're two totally different things, which is always something that I've found very surprising and somehow very unique to that little island.
On your last trip, who is the most memorable person you met?
I would say the owners of the Place Dinos Hotel. They were so full of what a wonderful place that they had purchased, which I suppose is natural, but they were also wonderful hosts and full of the most intriguing stories and information about their B&B. And you almost got the feeling that they themselves were good friends of the Armstrong Jones, that they themselves had been to Buckingham Palace. And the fact that I'm mentioning it to you makes me realize again how they stood out, how unique they were, and what a special sort of thing that they provided. Another quick thing, I can't remember the name of the website, but I can probably send it to you. Another very unique thing that we did was, it was called something like Have a Dinner with the Welsh Family. And you can go, and the tourist office will arrange this for you. But I must tell you, when I was advised that we were going to go and have dinner with this Welsh family, I thought to myself, oh my dear, how boring this is going to be. And so we went to this really typical sort of UK, English, Welsh, Irish house. It reminded me so much of my youth in Great Britain, very sort of ordinary and all that sort of stuff. And I went take time describing it. But what was fascinating was the dinner they had prepared, the ease of their conversation, the ability of this family, the husband and wife, and they brought their daughter along who was 22. It was a real wonderful, unique insight into the Welsh people, their homes, the way they live. And it is a really clever idea, I think, in promoting tourism to your country, and a wonderful idea. And I don't know if that happens in America, but what a great idea that is.
Excellent, excellent. Final two questions. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Wales when what?
you really know you're in Wales when you see the road signs.
I think you were going there, actually.
When you see the sign in the road that says slow, S-L-O-W, underneath that is, I think, the word A-R-A-F. And you think, A-R-A-F, what does that mean? So you really know you're in Wales when you see signs that say things like, be careful of the steps. And that's just a brief sentence. And then underneath that is the Welsh, which seems to go on forever and ever. So it's really know you're in Wales when you see the language in signs.
I would think on the road signs, you wouldn't have to tell people to slow down. You have to slow down just to read the name of the city you're driving close to.
I can't tell you the number of times, Chris, I went on another trip to Wales several years ago, and every time we came to a sign like that, I'd say, stop the car, and got out, shot pictures of it. Yeah, because it's so unique. As I say, just the word slow, I mean, it's wonderful. And it's wonderful.
Excellent. And finally, if you had to summarize Wales in three words, what three words would you use?
I'll make it down to two. It's gorgeous.
All right. I owe you a word then. Should you ever come back on the show, you get four. So, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, you don't have a website right now where we can read more of your writings. If people want to know more from you, how can they get a hold of you?
There's two things, Chris. One, thank you very much for having me on your show. I've been to 51 countries around the world. I have a treasure trove of memories, and anytime you'd like to talk about any of them, I would be thrilled to talk to you and your audience. And for people who want to reach me, they can do it by sending me an email. It's really easy. It's my initials, jdcradio@cox.net, jdcradio@cox.net. And I'd be thrilled to talk to or answer any of your audience. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Before we go much further, I do want to apologize for how tinny my voice sounded in that interview. I'm afraid I was being recorded from the internal microphone instead of from my headset. Sometimes things go wrong. I do have one internet resource for you today, and that is a site called Geronimo.com, an odd name for a site where you can rent vacation rentals, and the proceeds go to charity. Now, I don't know a lot about this site, and I've never used it, but I thought it was an interesting idea, so you can check that out at Geronimo.com. I got two comments this week that were clarifying two previous shows, both by Agaguga, at least that's the name in the comments. And the first one was on the Borneo show, wanting to clarify that Borneo includes the whole island, and we really were only talking about the Malaysian part of Borneo on the show. And that's certainly true, and I'm sorry if we weren't clear about that. I had tagged the show with Malaysia, but I don't think that is currently showing up, obviously, in the site. So thank you for the clarification. And the second one, also by Agaguga, and I'm sorry I can't say that without laughing, was on last week's show on Hiroshima and Chugoku. It says, great show. I was in Hiroshima 2 years ago. Some bits to add. Hiroshima Castle is reconstructed. The exhibits inside are not bad, but a concrete castle exterior isn't very nice. There aren't many castles left in Japan. Most were dismantled during the feudalism's death throes. There's a great one, also a UNESCO World Heritage Site at Himeji near Kyoto. But unlike Haji, there's no castle town around it. Miyajima has some nice shrines at the top of Mount Misen, the sacred mountain. Some are connected with the monk who brought Buddhism to Japan. I also ran into some monkeys there, too. Your guest didn't mention that rail passes can only be bought outside Japan. Very important to know. So thanks again for both of those comments. This show will come out on March 27th, 2010, and there are still a few days left to enter the March photo contest if you pick this up when it first comes out. And even if you don't, check out the photos that are being submitted to the Facebook page, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. There's some really good ones. I've been reposting a number of them at blog.amateurtraveler.com as daily photos because they've been really enjoyable. So check those out and preferably enter the contest. Remember, the theme is spring or reflection, or some have done reflections of spring. And remember, the winner of that contest gets a copy of Ralph Velasco's book. And Ralph and I, again, are doing that photo tour of Egypt in November. Again, check that out at amateurtraveler.com/tours. With that, we'll start to wind this show down. Remember, this show is a member of the Travelcast Network. You can find other travel shows at travelcastnetwork.com. And remember, if you join the email newsletter at amateurtraveler.com/newsletter, I'll send you a free electronic book on how to save money when you book travel online. If you want to leave me a question, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. As always, thanks so much for listening.
One more cathedral, I got to sit in one more cafe.